Hi again, everybody. I'm Dan Hoard, and thanks for downloading the Bengals Booth Podcast. You got what I need edition. As my broadcast partner Dave Lapham joins me to discuss the Bengals' biggest needs going into the draft. He'll rank them from number 5 to number 1. Also coming up on this edition, we'll hear from Bengals president Mike Brown on the great Forrest Gregg, who passed away last week at the age of 85. And in our fun facts segment, I'll visit with the 215th pick in the 1987 NFL draft, who became a starter on the Bengals' second Super Bowl team and later an outstanding NFL broadcaster. All of that is straight ahead, but first, here's a quick reminder that you can have the latest edition of this podcast delivered right to your phone, tablet, or computer by subscribing on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or Podbean. It's the greatest invention since auto-correction. That useful tool commonly found on computer keyboards and smartphones to fix spelling errors. It's almost always helpful, except when I reach out to my friends, the Mortons, and call them the morons. Now let's get to football. Last week, we learned of the passing of one of the greatest figures in Bengals history, Forrest Gregg. He was a Hall of Fame player, a 9-time Pro Bowl offensive tackle with the Green Bay Packers and Dallas Cowboys, who was named to the NFL's 75th anniversary team. Green Bay coach Vince Lombardi once called Forrest the best player I ever coached. He came to Cincinnati in December of 1979 at the age of 46, after the team had gone 4-12 under Homer Rice. 2 seasons later, the Bengals were 12-4 and on their way to their first Super Bowl. Over the years, I've talked to Bengals president Mike Brown on several occasions about Forrest Gregg. Here are a few of the questions and answers. Today we're going to look at some of the great coaches, head coaches and assistant coaches in Bengals history with Mike Brown. Let's start with Forrest Gregg. When I say that name, what immediately comes to mind?
Probably for me something altogether different than for the normal fans. Forrest and I are good friends. We were friends when he was here. He is still a good friend. He's retired. He lives out in Colorado Springs, Barbara and he. The thing about Forrest as a coach that sticks in my mind is how he was perceived by the players. He had been a great player himself. He presented a daunting presence. He was a big, powerful man, and even the players would have thought twice about challenging him in any way, physically included. He was thought of as a disciplinarian by the players, as a hard taskmaster, and he was privately anything but that. He was a sweet, gentle person. I'm very fond of him. But he did a great job for us. He got us to the Super Bowl. And really, it's a shame that we didn't win that game. In my heart of hearts, we were the better team that day. But we managed to fumble the ball away and lose. I think of Forrest a lot. And I've tried to explain that it goes beyond just the coaching part.
I read Forrest Gregg's biography recently, and he described coming to Cincinnati to interview for the head coaching job. It took place at your father's house, and 3 people were there: Forrest, your dad, and you. What do you remember about that meeting?
I hate to tell you, nothing. But I remember Forrest so very well. He is a dear friend. When he coached here, we were social friends, Barbara, Forrest, and Nancy and I, and our friends Jack and Lynn Schiff. We'd go out every Friday night, and we had wonderful times together. It wasn't anything fancy, but it was just good fun for middle-aged people, which is what we were then. I have a fondness for Forrest that runs deep within me. He was a very successful coach here. He had a presence about him. The players respected him. They jumped when he said boo, and that was good.
I'm glad you mentioned your friendship because he mentioned something in his book I have a hard time believing. He said the two of you once went to see the movie Porky's. Do you remember that?
I do. It was a lousy movie, in my opinion. Jack Schiff liked it, which I always thought reflected on his standards. But that was the kind of thing that we used to do together, Forrest, Jack, and our wives and me. It was fun.
The Bengals have had 9 head coaches prior to Zach Taylor, and Forrest Gregg has the highest career winning percentage. Time to turn our attention to the NFL draft. It gets underway next Thursday, April 25th, and the Bengals have 11 selections, including number 11 overall. Here's hoping they do as well as the Houston Texans did in 2011 when they selected J.J. Watt with the 11th overall pick. So what are the Bengals' biggest needs? I asked my broadcast partner Dave Lapham to count them down. Lap, today we're really going to start building up to the draft by looking at the Bengals' biggest needs. I have asked you to come up with your top 5, and we are going to build up from the 5th biggest need to the biggest need. So let's get started with Dave Lapham's number 5 biggest need leading up to the draft.
Well, I think I was thinking outside cornerback, you know, for you can never have enough of those. But due to Mark Walton's problems and him being released from the team, I think maybe the 5th need might be a running back at some point, not early in the draft, but address that running back position with maybe one or more of their multiple 6-round picks that they've got, because you know, Joe Mixon led the AFC in rushing, obviously, and you knock on wood that he stays totally healthy. Giovanni Bernard's starting to get up there a little bit in terms of life expectancy of a running back, and he's had, you know, some injury history. So I'd probably go with the running back position maybe at number 5 now, based on what took place with Mark Walton. And I really do think that Zach Taylor sent a message, you know, and I think a very positive one to his football team. Basically, you know, loose translation, you guys that are out there doing things right and working toward, you know, the common goal, and it's all about us is his slogan. Can't be about an individual, you know, in his mind, Mark Walton didn't fit that and let him go. So
you feel the same way about Vontaze?
You know,
or
I think,
is that more football?
I think it ended up being more football. You know, I think it's interesting when you're in a situation when a new coaching staff comes in, I think every player, and I asked A.J. Green this earlier in the locker room, you know, as great as you are, do you still feel like I'm back at square one because it's a new evaluation by new eyes? And, of course, you knew A.J. was going to answer like that. Yes, I'm, you know, but he's a true professional. But sometimes when coaches that have been around a long time with players look at a guy on tape, they're not looking at how he's playing as much as they like him. There's such a relationship there that it jaundices how he's playing. And a fresh set of eyes come in and they put the tape on, and what, you know, one set of coaches thought was good play or adequate play, another set of coaches might be like, what? And it's because they don't know anything about the guy, nothing about his personality. And sometimes that's hard to separate. It's very hard to separate, particularly, you know, when you've been around a guy for a long time and at some point in time he has been productive for you. So that's an interesting one. But I do think that the contribution to the amount of money paid caught Vontaze Burfict probably a little bit.
Talk about a disappointment. Mark Walton did not work out at all. Obviously, the off-field problems ultimately doomed him in Cincinnati, but did not produce as a runner or as a receiver. And while he contributed on special teams, he was not this special team star that we were led to believe that he might turn out to be.
And I wonder if some of these problems that cropped up might have been issues. You know, obviously, he was running with the wrong crowd. You know, you go to University of Miami, there has to be a group of positive influences that you can lean on, and all he was leaning on was obviously negative influences. Be packing the gun he's packing. I mean, come on. And you're probably in the same boat, Dan. I'm approaching 67 years old. I've never been arrested. Dude was arrested 3 times in 3 months. Come on. You know, somebody in his life has to say after the first mess up, okay, come on, Mark, you know, let's straight. After number 2, it's like, dude, you're not getting this. You're not figuring this out. Come on. There's going to be an intervention here. And then a trifecta? I mean, something's wrong there. And I'm more worried about him as a person than a football player, really, at this point. You go 3 times in 3 months, that's a bad show.
Do speeding tickets count where I'm concerned?
No, not speeding tickets. Okay. It has to be, you know, up against the car, spread them, up against the wall, spread them.
Well, you know, one thing we've learned about the Bengals in recent years, you can get running backs late in the draft or even as undrafted free agents. Rex Burkhead was a late pick, turned out to be a great NFL player. Trey Carson, I think, would have worked out okay as a third running back had he stayed with the Bengals long term. So whether they use one of those sixth round picks or potentially earlier, or obviously they're going to bring in undrafted free agents at that position, they're certainly going to add to that position group.
A sixth-round pick that I can think of that scored a touchdown in the Super Bowl, Rex Burkhead, Cincinnati Bengals. Not bad. I mean, I agree with you. You're going to be able to find somebody that's going to be able to make a contribution for the football team for sure, no doubt.
All right, so number 5 position of need, running back. How about the number 4 position of need?
Probably defensive tackle, you know, I'm thinking. With Ryan Glasgow with the injury, you just never know. He seems like he's coming back tremendously. I mean, he's and I'm going to say he is. He's going to come back 100% or maybe even better. That's just the kind of guy he is. I mean, he's got a tremendous work ethic. He's blue collar, lunch pail, all those cliches. I mean, he trimmed himself down to like right around 280 pounds to put less stress on his knee as he's rehabbing. And I mean, he does everything right. He's a smart guy. He's a tough football player. But you know, Billings has been erratic. It's been up and down. His play has been spotty. He was a 4th-round pick coming in. You know, Glasgow not, you know, a 1st or 2nd-round pick or 1st-day or 2nd-day pick either. So, I mean, those guys have panned out. But wouldn't bother me if they drafted another interior defensive lineman, more of the run stuffer, you know, mentality to go along with the Geno Atkinses of the world.
Can you find a mammoth guy at that spot? Because I guess Josh Tupou kind of fits that description, but they haven't had that immovable object type of guy in the middle.
Right, and that's what you're thinking. And, you know, Josh is one of those kind of guys. He's hard to knock off the ball. He's got really good balance. You know, he's a big man, obviously. But somebody of that ilk, for sure. I could see them, you know, as their 4th need, maybe going in that area.
All right, running back, defensive tackle, what's next?
You know, I'm thinking you may have to think about a tight end. You know, obviously, you have the tight end. You lose Tyler Kroft to the Buffalo Bills. Tyler Eifert, you know, it's like, man, is this the year where it's finally going to – the football gods are going to leave him alone and he can stay healthy? Because, you know, we talked earlier in the day with him about this. This offense, potentially, that is being assembled – is going to be very tight end friendly. And having a weapon like him, you make your offense tight end friendly, because he's basically, you know, I think tight end's a loose interpretation of what he gives you. He can play in the slot. He can play in the widest receiver in the formation. He runs routes like a wide receiver. The dude is a big wideout is what he is. He can run the route tree as well as a lot of wide receivers in the National Football League. Plus, he could, when healthy, he can still, you know, block at the end of the line of scrimmage. So, I mean, you know, I think you're always, you know, looking for an insurance policy there. Shrek, obviously, you know, he got hurt down the stretch. C.J. Uzama got his deal done. But, you know, it would not surprise me if they go for a tight end somewhere in the middle of the late rounds of the draft as a need at that point.
I think they've got to. The other thing about Eifert is, not only is it impossible to know how many games he's going to play because of his injury history, but it's only a 1-year deal. So who knows what's going to happen? What if he stays healthy and has 1,000 yards and 15 touchdowns?
Exactly. You know, it's a show-me year, and he had a show-me year last year and obviously had the tragic injury. It's another show-me year, and if it goes the other way and he shows the league, it'll be a hot commodity, no question about it. Now, there'll always, with his injury history, there'll always be like, oh, geez, do we commit those kind of dollars? And, you know, is the 1 year of health a blip? Is it an aberration? Is, you know, this is the history. This is the trend. Is this the anomaly? So teams have to make that kind of a decision. But yeah, I mean, man, if he puts it together though and has a huge year, Bengals are in good shape. They're in high cotton because that position group, I still feel like when the New England Patriots had their two tight ends working with Gronk and the murderer, God rest his soul. I don't know where he's resting, but I'm probably in hell. But at any rate, Hernandez and Gronk, that was incredible. I mean, that was a very, very difficult package to deal with. And I think, you know, sometimes contrarian thinking and approach can be the way to go. Everybody's spreading it out now and doing all this. If you have two tight ends on the football field that are adequate enough blockers, but you can put anywhere in your formation and throw it. And Hernandez, they had running the ball. I mean, the dude was running the ball and everything. I mean, it was ridiculous. And if you've got athletic tight ends like these guys could be, that could be very, very interesting for the Bengals.
Running back, defensive tackle, and tight end, we are up to the Bengals' number two positional need going into the draft.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to say offensive line. I'd have to say offensive line and linebacker are, you know, kind of one and 1A, so they're two and one. But, you know, let's talk about the offensive line, I think, at this point. You know, and I do think they're going to have to address it in the draft. Do I think they addressed it at number 11? I really don't. Because when I look at the top guys, every guy has a hole in his play. There's not a Munoz. There's not a Bisselli. There's not a, like, you know, Orlando Pace is not like, oh, my gosh, man. They wouldn't make it to 11 anyway. But I think when they get to 11, there'll be other options on the board besides those tackles that they'll have rated higher on their board, because I think you're going to be able to get a quality tackle early too, which, you know, they're in the early stages, and even into the third round. So I think they're going to wait and not necessarily go there at that point.
So tackle specifically, not just O-line in general, but tackle specifically is the number two need.
I'd say O-line,
okay.
You know, in general, highlighted by the tackle. But, I mean, there are some good guards in this draft. You know, Chris Lindstrom from Boston College, I think is a pretty darn good guard. Jonah Williams can play center or guard out of Alabama, and he's like a Clint Bowling. You could get not just a game, you could get four games out of him if you kick him out to tackle. I think he'd be a heck of a center. I think he'd be a really good guard. You know, I think he gives you a lot of position versatility. I think Chris Lindstrom from Boston College is another guard that's, you know, pretty good quality. I'd say he's a late one, early two. No, none of these guys are worth an 11 in my estimation, but there are a lot of guys that are, you know, first round, late first, early second, you know, all through the second into the early third. There's a myriad of linemen that they can go to. I really think, like we talked about before, Dan, this draft fits a lot of teams' needs, because a lot of teams have needs like the Bengals, but the Bengals have front seven defensive needs and offensive line needs. And this draft is really deep at those. I'm not saying there are mega stars at every one of the positions, but, you know, well past the first round, you're going to get a damn good football player to address those areas where they do have needs.
And therefore, linebacker is the number one need.
I think linebacker, you know, if there's a position on the team that I think they're going to double down on in the draft, I think it's going to be linebacker. And like we talked about before, you know, the two Devons, and all of this for the 11th pick of the draft could be trumped by, in my mind, if there's an edge rusher, you take them. If there's an edge rusher that you have rated higher, and it might be one of these linebackers, you know, some of these, they're quote, you know, they're rush guys, but they're in the draft, they're like linebackers instead of defensive ends. But I'm talking about an edge rush guy, because Dan, in this era of throwing the football, you know, there are two ways to help prevent it. You're going to have to hurry the quarterback up, make him hurry his reads, and hope he makes a mistake. The way to do that is by a good pass rush. And then to compound that, if you have really good options up front, you have multiple weapons, they start doubling people, there's less guys that they're going to send out in routes. So your coverage percentages jump up. So it starts, in my estimation, it always starts with a good edge rush or good rush in general up front. Because if you have to keep, you know, if you can't get away with ever leaving five in, you have to go six, sometimes seven, and max protect. I mean, you've lightened the burden in the back end immensely. And so it starts there. I mean, if you can get a cover corner, great. But if you can get an edge rusher that is a difference maker, I think that trumps everything, even though it might not be a glaring need based on how Carl Lawson comes back.
That's what I was gonna
say. You know,
if you don't find a guy that drops to number 11, you do have Carl Lawson coming back from his torn ACL.
Exactly. But here's four defensive linemen. I think Nick Bosa is long gone. I think Montez Sweat out of Mississippi State. I mean, the dude's 6'6", 240 plus and ran a 4.4. I'd be surprised if he's there. But Jared Allen? Josh Allen. Jared Allen's a quarterback. Josh Allen, 6'4". 265, 4'6", 540. And he was a 50-50 rush guy at Kentucky. I mean, they had him, you know, playing true linebacker. 17 sacks in the SEC. That's production, man. I mean, if that guy's there, I'd really think about that at 11.
Won't be there.
Yeah. And then Rashawn Gary out of Michigan. That'd be my fourth guy. And he might be because watching early tape on him, it's like, whoa. But last year, somebody got in his ear, and he was playing to survive in advance to the draft. And I, you know, to me, the fact that he didn't get hurt, he's fortunate, because that's how you do get hurt. But he was just getting through it, it looked like to me. He didn't even look a lot of times like the same guy. But this dude, man, 6'4 plus, 287, 4'6'9. I mean, that's a freakazoid athletically. So if he's there at 11, you got to think about that. If Devin White's there at 11, boom, I'm on him as well. Mm-hmm. Now, Devin Bush, the other Devin, he's the one that, as I'm looking at him and talk to people around the league about him, there's a 50-50 split. Some people are like, man, he's just so small. And he is small. I mean, he's 5'11", 230 pounds. And, you know, Devin White runs faster at 6'1", 240. But he's still plenty fast at 4.65. And all I can say is I played against Sam Mills in the USFL. I don't care. That playing against him just left an everlasting imprint in my mind. And it ain't the size of the dog in the fight, it's the size of the fight in the dog. That dude, he knew what his limitations were. He knew that he didn't want to let you engulf him. And that's what people are going to say. Devin Bush is going to get engulfed by these big guys in the NFL. You don't think that was his concern in the Big Ten? He knows what his limitations are. He doesn't put himself in a position to be taken advantage of like that. You have to catch him to engulf him, you know? And I mean, these guys know they've always had the, quote, deficiency, and they've still competed at a high level. I have faith that he's going to compete still at a high level. That's why I'm leaning toward, even though he is undersized, going there. But the way all these teams are, I mean, it's 85% nickel now anyway, and you want a smaller linebacker, a linebacker that can cover. That might be a smaller linebacker. It's not going to be a big dude anyway. I mean, now it's hybrid safety / linebacker. You know, oh boy, that's like a big safety. That's not a linebacker, but the league is evolving to that. That's what this guy is. So, you know, maybe he's not, quote, your typical, man, that's a starting inside linebacker in the National Football League. In this era, he can play outside backer, and he's a good nickel backer. I mean, he's one of the two backers that you could throw out there and play nickel. You get a lot of snaps out of the guy. So I think that there's value, you know, still there at number 11. Because, man, I've chased a lot of small linebackers trying to engulf him. Got to catch him first, Dan.
When I watch Michigan games the last couple of years, he jumps off the screen.
Oh, big time. The dude, the thing about Sam Mills, and this kid has it too, even though, you know, you think, okay, I might engulf you, they have such explosive hip snap. I mean, they get under your pads because of the leverage. I mean, you have to come off the ball on your knees to get under their pads. They're under your pads, and they're just, all of a sudden, man, boom! I mean, they're exploding on you. It's like, man, that was a little dynamite cap that just went off. It's unbelievable. It's like you have a surge from a guy like that. They know what they're doing. I mean, he's obviously been one of the best football players on a great defense until they played Ohio State, you know, that the NCAA has had. I mean, he was one of the kingpins. So, to me, I mean, you compete at that level and you're still, you know, a high level. I really like the guy. It's going to be very interesting, you know, offensive linemen. As I'm looking at some of the offensive linemen, there's a bunch of guys. There are a bunch of guys. This Andre Dillard kid from Washington State's a little bit of intrigue. Titus Howard, this kid from Alabama State, 6'4", over 300 pounds, Alabama State, though. I mean, he has not played an NFL schedule against NFL-caliber talent. He's played that division schedule, which is, what, no more than 12 games against lesser mm-hmm. talent. But can you project his talent to be successful in the league? Heck yeah. Chris Lindstrom from Boston College is a guard. Greg Little in Mississippi, you know, at the tackle position. Dalton Risner out of Kansas State, you know, at the tackle position. I think there are these are all, you know, like late one, early two kind of guys. Caleb McGarry out of Washington. Isaiah Prince, Ohio State. I mean, these are, you know, early second round guys or second and third round guys. There are a ton of offensive linemen. That's why I think, you know, when I look at it, unless the best in the draft has slid to 11, and that number one offensive tackle is better than the second linebacker, the third or fourth rush guy or whatever, however you have your board. And every team in the league now is in the process of you know, stacking their board by position group, and then the top 10, top 20, top 50 players. Nobody's done with that equation yet. So that's when you start, you know, mixing and matching a little bit.
Your top five positional needs did not include quarterback.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's always, that's why it didn't include an edge rush guy. But if one of those guys is there at 11, boom, see ya. I'm sprinting to the podium. If Haskins slides to 11, woo, interesting room at that point. If you know, somebody that the Bengals had as a first-round grade slides to, you know, their position in the second round, you have to discuss them all the time. But, you know, I would not be stunned if they take a quarterback, you know, anywhere in the draft, if there's a slide. But I'm not sure that there will be. It'd be interesting to see.
Thanks, Lap. Next week, an annual edition of this podcast that gets downloaded as many times as The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro, and this is The Daily. How's that for an imitation? We'll get Lap's prediction for the Bengals' number one pick next week. Now time for a Fun Facts interview, and my guest was an eighth-round draft pick in 1987. 1 year later, the 1988 Super Bowl Bengals featured one of the finest secondaries in team history, a quartet that earned a memorable nickname, the SWAT Team. Time for some fun facts with a guy who is picked 40th on the list of the top 50 retired players in Bengals history, former safety Solomon Wilcott, an eighth-round draft pick out of Colorado back in 1987. Is it true you did not even have a phone on draft day?
That's very true. You do your homework. I had two roommates my senior year in college who refused to pay the phone bill. And so I said, well, I could go ahead and pay it, but then they're going to use it and run it up every month, and I'm going to be stuck with a bill. So what I did is I went ahead and allowed them to disconnect it because the other two wouldn't pay, and I would use the phone of my friend who lived across the hall from me. And so when we were going through the whole draft process, they says, we want your draft day phone number. I knew I was going to be at my apartment in Boulder, Colorado, but I had to give Cam Jones's phone number. This is the last guy that you want to give out his number to control something that's so important in your life. But, yeah, I gave him that number, and I just remember him yelling across the hall. He said, Moon, that's what he called me, Moon, Cincinnati Bengals are on the phone. And I had to run over to his apartment, and there was Dick LeBeau on the phone. It was one of the best phone calls I ever received, and it wasn't even on my phone.
We're doing fun facts with Solomon Wilcott. You mentioned Dick LeBeau. You once said he unlocked the mysteries of football. In what way?
In ways that help you to understand what offenses are trying to do to you and what you needed to do to stop them. It's something as simple as this. Offenses, they are the ones who are on a clock. That quarterback doesn't get to hold on to the ball forever. He's got to get rid of it. And his receiver has to get to the designated point at the time when the quarterback expects him to get there. And if he's not there, it's an incomplete. And if you get there first, you get to catch it, it's an interception. That the timing of the offense, everything's predicated on timing. And as a defensive back, your job is just to disrupt timing. You don't have to cover the guy all over the field like defensive backs believe they have to. All you have to do is disrupt timing. You got pass rush helping you to do that. You got the quarterback's insecurity of getting blitzed to help with that. And you get to jam the receiver at the line of scrimmage to help to prevent timing. So just something as simple as that goes such a long way in unlocking a mystery of what NFL offenses are all about and what they're trying to do to you.
We're visiting with Solomon Wilcots. David Fulcher checked in at number 6 on the list, the highest rated defensive back. And one of the reasons why he was so effective in freelancing on defense is that you helped cover for him in the secondary. Was that instinct on your part, or was it very choreographed? When Fulcher does this, I've got to do that.
It was about knowing that Dave would take chances, that Dave, and he had great instincts. He had not only the ability to make it work, he had the instincts to be able to do it at a time when the offense never thought he would. And I kind of had to know when he started creeping up to the line of scrimmage, I said, oh, no, he's blitzing, and he's not supposed to blitz. He's supposed to cover over here. So someone had to cover. And I just remember a few Mondays after we would have games, and Dick LeBeau, I mean, he would give it to me. He would just – and I'm like, oh, coach, I didn't make – you didn't complain. You just took it. But I remember one Monday I went in, I asked Coach LeBeau, I said, hey, is there something wrong here? Am I mistaken? David made the mistake, but then you ripped me. He was like, that's your job. Your job is to be wherever he's not. And he helped me to understand that what kind of player David was and how he used David in the defense. Ryan Clark, who played for Dick LeBeau in Pittsburgh, had to do the same kind of things. He and I would have these conversations. He never knew what Troy Polamalu was going to do. Troy Polamalu in Pittsburgh playing for Dick LeBeau was the same exact player that David Fulcher was 20 years prior, playing in the same defense. And so that's how Dick LeBeau used his strong safety and his free safety and finding that right player. And David was that guy now who had instincts and incredible ability for a big man to go out and make big plays.
We're doing fun facts with Solomon Wilcots. In training camp before your second season, Sam Weich decided to mix things up. He took black players and roomed them with white players. He took offensive players and roomed them with defensive players. Mm-hmm. What impact did that have?
Bruce Reimers, offensive lineman, was my roommate. I would visit Eric Thomas. I think he was with Joe Walter. Anybody know, Joe was a grumpy dude. You know, Joe didn't play. But Eric is such a jolly guy that he could bring out the best in a Joe Walter. But Sam, it worked. Sam knew what he was doing. Other than that, I'm a defensive back. We don't hang out with offensive linemen. And there's no way that a guy from California and Eric Thomas is going to hang out with a guy from Texas like Joe Walter. I mean, so that kind of forward thinking, it did help us become closer as a team. We were able to spend time off the field with one another and with guys that we normally would not have spent time with. And I just remember week 2, we went out and played Philadelphia that year. That's the year that the Eagles had a great team. Buddy Ryan's the coach. They got big Reggie White on the defensive line, Jerome Brown, Chris Carter, Mike Quick, Randall Cunningham. He had a great team. And we went out there, and they jumped out on us. But I just remember during that period, we stuck together. The offensive line started taking over. Defense, we started making plays. We got out of there with a win. But I think it was on that day, week 2 in 88, that we really knew that we had a chance to be a great team. And we were close, and we had one another's back no matter what happened. And even when we went through some bumpy spots in the season, there was never any doubt that we were kind of a team of destiny.
A couple more questions for Solomon Wilcots. That team goes to Super Bowl 23. The night before the game, unfortunately, Stanley Wilson had his cocaine relapse. Mm-hmm. You were one of the last people that spoke to him before the team found out, correct?
Yeah, that is true. I remember he and Eddie Brown, myself, and Eric Thomas, we're on the same floor, so we got on the elevator together to get ready to go down to a team meeting. And Stanley, at the last minute, says, as the door was closing, says, I forgot my playbook. And he shot out, and the door closed behind him as he went back to his room. We're sitting in the meeting room that night, and they said, is everyone here? Sam asked, and I remember Eddie was like, hey, Stanley went to go get his playbook. He said, he'll be here in a second. So we're waiting 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and, you know, Sam's thinking, we got to get this meeting going. Let's start the meeting. But he sent Jim Anderson back to go get Stanley. Next thing you know, maybe 15 minutes later, Sam, with tears in his eyes and, you know, sort of interrupted everyone, said, guys, Stanley couldn't make it. And we were like, what are you talking about? He proceeded to tell us about the relapse that Stanley had. And, you know, that's something that has stuck with me for about 30 years, you know, for all this time. And, you know, I talk with Marvin about this. I talk with a lot of other NFL coaches about when you go to a Super Bowl, this is where character really counts. This is where all having the right people on your team counts. And not that Stanley was a bad person, but it's just about understanding that the pressure of such a game and of such a moment, it's going to reveal all things. I remember Chris Berman and I were talking at one Super Bowl. We were providing coverage and something had happened with one player in Miami. And I coined the phrase by saying, you know, you can only win the game the day of kickoff, but you can lose it between now and kickoff. In other words, some player slips out into the night, does something silly, and next thing you know, that it serves as a huge distraction for their team who's trying to get ready to play the game of their lives. So that's what I remember about it. I do remember a few years later going out to California. I was covering for ESPN as a correspondent. A case where Stanley Wilson was, he was going to get three strikes and you're out. So he was going to get life for robbery, for a home invasion. And I watched the judge render the verdict. I remember writing a letter to the judge saying Stanley never hurt anyone physically. He only hurt himself. And I tried to prevail on the judge to not give him life. I don't agree with the mandatory prison sentencing. And so Stanley Wilson does not deserve to be in jail for life for what he did. We all forgive him. We love him. But I know what? He was one heck of a football player. I wish he would have played that day. We needed somebody to block Ronnie Lott. Trust me.
Last thing for Solomon Wilcots. You're from California.
Mm-hmm.
You went to Colorado.
Yeah.
But you settled in Cincinnati after playing for the Bengals. Yeah. What is it about this team and this city that got under your skin?
Well, it was interesting because when I was drafted, I remember I didn't quite know where Cincinnati was. I had never been east of the Mississippi River. And so when I came here, I didn't know what to expect. But, you know, I started working for an insurance firm over at Midland, American Modern Home. And I worked there every year during the offseason. I worked as an underwriter, worked as a claim adjuster. I worked in our HR department. And then when I was done playing, I went over to Channel 5 and worked with some really good people there who were great to me. I learned so much from them. And I don't know that I would still be here had I not had the opportunity to work with such good people and have them in my life. None of us succeed on our own. We need a community of people. And I always wanted to be able to at least give back to that community in some way, shape, or form. And I think that's what makes Cincinnati special. I think it is a place that is about community. And I think the people here can tell if you're genuine or not. They could tell if you are a hard worker. They could tell if you're in it for you or if you're in it for the big picture. If you're in it for the big picture, it works out. If you're in it for you, it doesn't go so well. And so I that's what I love about Cincinnati. I tell people, even when I go back to L.A., people are like, you still live in Cincinnati? How could you live there? I said, you know what? It's a great place. We don't have traffic. I don't have to wait in line at the post office. I go to the coffee shop. My girl already has my coffee made. She knows me. And I that's what I love. That's what I like. And that's what makes Cincinnati a special place. I love it.
My thanks to Solomon Wilcots, and thank you for downloading this episode of the podcast. Don't forget, we'll take an in-depth look at the most likely targets at the top of the Bengals draft board next week and get Dave Lapham's first-round prediction. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or Podbean. And if you have a minute, give it a rating or leave a comment. Your feedback's been great, and 5-star ratings help more Bengals fans find this podcast. I'm Dan Hoard, and thank you for listening to the Bengals Booth Podcast.